which may help us to orient ourselves a little bit in the Baba Chakra, the wheel of becoming,
sometimes described as the wheel of life, slightly erroneously, because life in Buddhist teaching means birth and death. So it's maybe more sensible to translate this image, the wheel of becoming. This goes back to, while what you have in front of you is a photocopy of something that was a Tibetan colored tanka, presumably, or maybe a wood print. The actual teaching device, the visual aid that is at the basis of this type of image in front of you, it goes back to very early Buddhism. The Divyavadana says that the Buddha was actually drawing the 12 links and the wheel of becoming into the sand to explain to his monks the intricacies of dependent origination, of the six spheres, of the three root poisons, and of the bardos in the middle. Now, unfortunately, we don't have a big, huge picture with a beamer I could project onto the wall and then individually take you through the different significance of the aspects, because there's a lot of Buddhist philosophy in this, just to say that. I have here a colored version, and I just like to pass this round. I'll fish out my black and white one so that I'm not losing track. And there are many, many type of depictions. The most famous ones are Tibetan. The climate in Tibet being a little more friendly to paper than in northern India made it possible that the Tibetans very early printed their texts. And while the early Buddhist schools, they inscribed their text on palm leaves, they scratched them on palm leaves and oiled the palm leaves to preserve the writing, which does a quite good job if you don't happen to have a few invaders who burn down monasteries and their libraries. Palm leaves can last 1,000 years. In Tibet, the practitioners have printed, they have made paper. The dryness of the air has allowed it to be possible to use paper, and they have carved wood blocks and printed things. So the Tibetan texts have been handed down on printed, folded leaves of paper, while the early Buddhist texts in Sri Lanka, in Burma, in Thailand, in India, have been in scratched palm leaves. This here is a fake version of... Hey, that's time.
Uh-huh. We don't know what it says.
I'll tell you later.
Okay. Yeah,
but this is a... This is... actually, this is genuine palm leaf here, as I see. But the inscription of it is fake. You know, it's printed. It's no longer scratched. Originally, the word for writing in Pali is lekati. Lekati means scratching. So you have a wooden piece, and then you have an iron thorn, and you scratch on it. And then you would cover this with oil. You know, generally, these things, as you see, actually, you have a hole drilled in the middle. Usually you have that repeated on the other side. You have left and right. You have, I think, like in Hebrew, you use the letters to number the pages. Yeah. And you would open this, and then you would fold this around. Take this off, you would fold this around. Then you would read and recite, and read and recite. Yeah. Can I pass that around to show people?
Yeah.
Because what a little charming idiosyncrasy to have this here. So, the Tibetans very early started painting on silk. Yeah. And their paintings became famous. They were preserved very well. We have Tibetan tankas from the 12th century. And some of those tanka paintings were paper and then embroidered silk, or they were directly on silk, or... they were decorated images, and they were used, as in medieval churches, as teaching devices. One of the things happened, I just passed that round, one of the things that happened with Buddhism when it moved from country to country, it needed to adapt to what people were capable of picking up. When Buddhism moved from India to Tibet, something very fascinating happened. Tibet was not having a writing at that time. Tibet was a pretty rough country, and the Buddhist teachings, which in India were scriptural, were hinging on debate, on dialogue, on vivid exchange, moved from basically the left hemisphere into the right hemisphere. You can see this big shift that Buddhist teachings, which are text-based in India, because in India the climate is such that you can meet, that you can talk, that you can't preserve images. That's one of the things. Subtropical climate doesn't really allow for preservation of images for a very long time, let alone Muslim invaders, which didn't help the process. But so the Tibetans took many of the scriptural teachings and transposed them into images. So what you get here, if you look at this image in front of you, let's identify a couple of elements before we go into the details. Outside, you have this fellow with the teeth here, with the three eyes and the claws. This is Yama, the god of death. And what Yama has in his claws, this wheel, in fact, is a mirror. Yeah, it is a mirror, and he holds that mirror to the onlooker and says, "This is your life. This is unenlightened mind at work. Yeah. All you get, this is this." If we look at, Yama has a tiara, he has in his head crown, he has five skulls. These are the five groups, the five aggregates: form, vedana, of a feeling, sanya, perception, sankhara, volition, vijnana, consciousness. Those are the five headings all human experience can be lumped under. You know, this is a nominal category. All these five groups of existence are affected by mara, by death, by mortality. Nothing in there is of a abiding solidity. Nothing is a true refuge. Everything in there is impermanent, is unpersonal, impersonal, and it hinges on conditions. That's why the skulls are there. Mortality is in all of those five groups. Then we have, on the right side of my image, you have a monk. Usually, if you have the colored version, may I? Can you hold it up quickly? Yeah. In the colored version, you have not just a monk, you have the Buddha, if you look up on the top right. So there are some of these images have variants. Generally, there is a Buddha out there pointing with his finger to the full moon. The full moon is always a symbol of enlightenment. It's the coolness of a full moon's light. As you may witness tonight, it's a very auspicious full moon tonight, is the symbol for enlightenment. It's radiant, it's immaculate, it's cool. It has become cool. So the Buddha points with his finger to the full moon, to the possibility of enlightenment. You notice the Buddha stands outside. Here in this image we have, by my reckoning, I would say this is an Avalokiteshvara here, the one with the lotus hand, or a Padmapani, one of the early statues and precursors of Avalokiteshvara. Padma is a lotus holder. And on the other side you have somebody, looks like a monk rather than the Buddha. Generally it's a monk, it's the Buddha who points to enlightenment, standing outside the wheel. Then you have in the wheel itself, at the hub of it, you see the three poisons, the three mental poisons: greed, hatred, and delusion, personified. Delusion personified by a pig, hatred personified by the snake, and greed personified by the rooster. Yeah? You see that at the very hub?
In the middle.
Can you repeat about the three one?
Yes. At the very center of the wheel, if you look at, I'm pointing, yeah? You have the three animals that stands for the three fundamental poisons in Buddhist psychology. Ignorance, personified by the pig. Hatred or aversion, personified by the snake. And greed personifies the rooster. Now, sometimes these animals hold each other's tails so that they go round. Sometimes, and this is the depiction I generally favor, is when two of the animals come out of the pig's mouth, meaning greed and hatred come out of the mouth of ignorance. Only under the influence of ignorance can we believe that pursuing greed or pursuing hatred makes us happy. Yeah, exactly. So that's the very center of the wheel. Then the next circle of the wheel, you have creatures going up and down. If you look closely, one circle further out, you have six realms. Above here is the realm of the gods. Below is the hell realm. Then one to the left is the realm of the hungry ghost, pretas. Up here is the realm of the humans. On the left side you have the realm of the titans, the asuras. And further down left you have the realm of the animals. We'll go into this in a moment. If you look at the inside, we go back to the second circle again. You have beings. This here, this circle here stands for the bardos, what in Tibetan Buddhism is called bardos. You have six bardos, six intermediate realms. Basically, this is all our life happens in bardo. Sleep is a bardo. What we do now is a bardo. If we die, we go into a bardo. When you get reborn, we go into a bardo. But you go into a bardo in a particular bardo process between one life and another life. And without wanting to proclaim that I am terribly knowledgeable about Tibetan Buddhism, I just make reference to this, and this is a Tibetan image, although all of this is straight in early Buddhism, but it's in text form, and it's a lot more interesting to look at this in image form rather than engulfing you with Pali words right now, which I will do anyway later on. So you have beings that, after death, are moving upwards to the brighter realms here. At the top you have a little god, and then the beings going down towards the hell realms. So these are the bardo state, in which beings move upwards into better realms of experience and downwards into lower, coarser realms of experience. To give you a brief sort of glimpse on your current position in Buddhist cosmology, if you want that, you are on story number 6 from the bottom. Yeah, this is above you there are 33 more god realms, and below you there are realms of, I mean, the hells. We have there's ways of counting different hells, but there's lots of them. And then you have the hungry ghost, you have the animal realm, and the hell realms, the better hell realms. So you're roughly, depending on the way you count, number on stage 5 or stage 6 in the Buddhist cosmology. If you think this is as good as it gets, you should be surprised. If we go outside, a circle outside, again, what you see in all of those fields is the appearance of the Buddha. You see a Buddha here in all of those six realms. You have, at the bottom, you will have to use your eyes to really make this out. You have unmitigated suffering in hell, generally epitomized by burning and freezing. And then there's usually a bit bloody goring and poking and hurting and torture. This kind of thing is going on, as goes generally on in hells. If you really want to know the details of this, you have to look Chinese Buddhism is famous for instigating fear in its followers by depicting the hells in great detail. It basically looks generally very much like Hieronymus Bosch, for those of you who are familiar with 14th century painting. But then we have the Buddha there appears in all of these realms. The Buddha appears with a particular symbol. In the hells, he generally appears with balm to cure, to soothe and to cure the suffering. The next step up, you have the pretas. As we're on the right-hand side here, this is the realm of the hungry ghosts. Into the hell realms, according to Buddhist psychology, you're likely to go through cruelty, through unmitigated hatred, through lack of responsibility, and such things bring you to hell. Further up is the realm of the hungry ghosts. The hungry ghosts, this is hard to discern. The hungry ghosts are people, they have huge bellies. They're insatiable because they have huge bellies and they have tiny little mouth. You know, their mouths are small, so they can never, ever get enough. Even if you give it to them, they can't take it because their mouths are so small and their bellies are so huge. As you can imagine, you're very likely to end up in the preta realm if you're greedy, if you're stingy. Miserliness is one of the major conditions why people go to the realm of the hungry ghost. The Buddha there has nectar to feed the hungry ghosts. One of the things hungry ghosts can take is nectar. So that's what the Buddha offers. One stage up, you have the human realm. The human realm doesn't look particularly attractive either because there's a lot of hard work, there is illness, there is birth. You see, bottom right, is a little picture of a woman giving birth. Yeah, you have to look really closely. But just to say, pause here, you will find this picture in many places. Many Buddhist places have big, big reproductions of this. And once you know your way around, you can identify these realms on many images. So take this as a very coarse sketch. But the same teaching applies. And once you learn how to identify the sequence, say the rings, the circles, you will clearly find these things sometimes in bigger, more colorful pictures. And it's a great joy to actually go through the aspects of the Buddhist teaching and look at how things are depicted. So the human realm, in Buddhist understanding, is the privileged realm. Although it's not the nicest, it's the privileged realm. It's the realm where compassion is possible. It's the realm where development is possible. It's the realm where growth and learning is possible. So you see, work, then you see the rider, you see somebody's doing something, somebody's really on a stick, walking, it's old and bent, somebody's lying on the floor there. You see a few animals, and at the rear you see something like a tent. And in that tent there's somebody teaching something. So that's the human realm. The Buddha comes in the human realm with the staff that monks carry and with the alms bowl. And the message the Buddha gives in the human realm is monk's requisites. You know, he gives you treading the path of the monk. You go up. You see, this is the realm of the devas. One of the really big changes that the Buddha did when he took the stage in Indian religious scene was he changed the role of the gods. He made the gods permanent, rather from being great creator gods, like in the Vedic mythology. In Buddhist mythology, gods are very lofty creatures. Some of them clever, some of them not so clever. Some of them shining and radiant, some of them a bit more like colorful, happy creatures. But all of them are permanent. They're all transitory. Godness, in Buddhist understanding, is not a permanent condition. So, in terms of the quality of what you can experience, being a deva is the top. Yeah, you have nice friends, the fruit are growing there, you have an incredibly long lifetime, you have very little suffering, but the whole thing has one little flaw, and the flaw is that it's going to end. Yeah. However long it lasts, it's going to end, and you will drop down, because one of the things is, you can only from the while you are being a god, you cannot do things that keep you being a god. You know, it's not sustainable. Yeah. Like hells are not sustainable, that's the good news. Yeah. Even if you end up there for a couple of lifetimes, you will creep out again, yeah, because you can't be as persistently nasty down there as it needs you to stay there. So you will inevitably, after eons, you will bubble up slightly. Yeah. But the same is true for the gods. So you can't actually stay up there. You know, even if you're behaving well, at some point you will start sweating, your lotus will start to wilt, and your aureole will start to wane. And then your fellow gods know that you're likely to disappear now in the immediate future. And shortly after, you'll pop up in one of the other realms, generally the Asura realm or the human realm. If you haven't been misbehaving really badly as a god, you should turn up in the human realm, you know, or in a lower godly realm. So what you see the Buddha does in the realm of the gods is he plays the lute of impermanence. Yeah, gods tend to forget because it's fine up there. Like we all know from ourselves, as soon as we feel very good, we tend to forget that things have come about through condition, and that they are likely, with the disappearance of those conditions, will disappear. Yeah. So he's trying to indicate to them by striking the lute of impermanence that their condition is not an eternal one. Then you have the demigods on the left, sometimes called titans. They are asuras. It's almost as good as with the gods. You notice the tree. Generally, there's a tree, and the tree grows in the realm of asuras, but some of the fruits are in the realm of the gods, so the asuras are terribly jealous. Yeah? The asuras have friends. The asuras have some fruits. They have nice, pleasant surroundings, but they can't enjoy it because they're jealous. Yeah? They're continually competing and fighting with the devas. So usually, I think on the other image, you may have a little bit of squibbling going on between the devas and the asuras. Usually there is some... No?
Only five.
There's only five, yeah. There's six, five. Yeah. So they've lumped in the asuras with the gods.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, yeah, they're in the god realm, the asuras are part of it.
Finally.
Well, that's a very liberal understanding. Yeah. This must be a reform movement. So, the asuras generally are the manager realm. Yeah, you have all the fantastic privileges, but you have no time to enjoy them, or you have to continually run. You have to keep up with the Joneses. Yeah, otherwise you're going to lose it. Yeah. So, while you try to really get what the gods are getting, and what you deserve, what you really truly deserve, while these lazy gods just get it, you have to fight for it. And that means that you don't enjoy the companionship, you don't enjoy the fruits, you don't enjoy the pleasure of just being, just having blissful mental states like the gods have. You know, one of the things gods do sometimes is meditate. They just sit there and absolutely bliss out. Yeah? And the asuras, they can't do that. They see the gods doing that, but they can't do that themselves. So the Buddha usually turns up in the Asura realm with a flaming sword. Yeah. To teach the Asuras decisiveness. Yeah. Clarity is a crucial thing. A mind that is obsessed with competition is a mind that is not liable to peace. It is not a mind that can obtain peace. Because you understand there's still an element of greed there, or an element of wanting, or deserving, or indignation, that stops us from making use of the good things that are already happening in our lives. We know that, you know, our we know that often a little illness or a little accident suddenly makes us more conscious of how good our lives are actually. Or a visit to Bihar, northern India, or something like that. So, one down from the asuras, we have the animal realm. Some of these animals look pretty happy. Some of them look haunted. So animals are creatures that they're basically... they're marked by a lack of reflectiveness, a lack of capacity to understand things. If they're happy, they're very happy and they're kind of procreating and they're feeding and they're having a good time. But if they're not happy, they're in fear, in terror. They're being eaten, they're being hunted. So if you ever looked at the rabbit, you know, it's quite capable of being happy and content and munching his grass, but the split between fear and just happily feeding itself is very small. There isn't much in between. No. You don't have an awful lot of contemplative, reflective capacity generally. You know, it's either, if it's not chased or hunted, it's likely to be eating or sleeping or multiplying its species. And if it's disturbed, its most prominent response is generally fear. It's very unlike that it's terribly curious or inquisitive or adventurous or so. Yeah. So there's a very small gamut of possible states. So that's the problem in the animal world. Besides the fact that you may definitely get eaten by some of your fellow animals. What the Buddha does, he turns up there and he usually holds a book in his hand. Yeah, he's trying to teach or instill reflectiveness, wisdom. What the Buddha brings what is most lacking. Yeah, so in the hell realm, he brings balm to cure the wounds. In the hungry ghost realm, he brings nectar to feed the big bellies. In the human realm, he teaches the sign of a renunciant. He teaches the sign of somebody who takes religious life to heart and makes much of a religious life. This is the symbol of the monk, which fits the Tibetan society. There are other ways of leading a religious life than being a monk or a nun, as we know. In the Deva realm, he teaches impermanence. He teaches the fact things are not likely to continue the way they are right now. Just because it's nice, it doesn't mean it's going to stay that way. In the Asura realm, he brings the sword to teach the asuras to stop indulging their impulses. In the animal realm, he brings what is most needed, namely extending the space where animals, where beings can be looking at what's happening to them, rather than just running away or running towards. Please?
You mentioned before that the human realm is the only one, or is it the only one where development can occur?
It's the most privileged. It's the most privileged one.
For development.
Yes.
Development can occur in other realms.
Yes. Yes. Definitely. You can become a gentle titan or an intellectual animal or so. This is possible. the Jataka stories, the Buddha's birth stories, which enjoy great popularity. In fact, many of the Western fables. Remember, you have fables that came across from India to Persia and from Persia to France when some of the La Fontaine's Conte, which I'm sure have made it into Hebrew, you will find traces of those stories in Indian Jataka stories. Yeah, they've come across with the traces to the west, to Persia first, and then from Persia they've come to Louis XIV, who gave it to some of their texts to La Fontaine and said, look, we'll do something with this. So you find countless fables about previous lives of the Buddha, because the Buddha has, before he became enlightened, in countless lives developed his perfections. And many of those lives have been stories. So in the Buddhist early texture, you only find the verses, but later on, a few hundred years later, you have whole stories, and many of those stories deal with animals sacrificing their lives. The Buddha being an animal, and in the guise of an animal, actually sacrificing its life for other things, and So you find animals capable of growing, animals capable of being an experience where a purification of the heart and development can happen. But obviously, it seems easier as a human being than, say, as a guinea pig. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think understanding dependent origination is already difficult enough as it is if we had to negotiate with the intelligence possible for a guinea pig, it probably wouldn't become a lot easier, I would think. So, these are the six realms, or the five realms, as in the colored picture. And if we look at the outer rim...
Excuse me. Are these metaphors of... are these metaphors of different forms of human existence?
Well,
is it that we can be human but actually live, exist in the animal realm or in the hell realm?
Yes, definitely. That's, you see, the as I said yesterday, there are various layers of that teaching, and the scriptures leave no doubt that there are such things as hells, that these are not just mind states. You know, every Tibetan Buddhist will tell you that this is not just a psychological depiction of mind states here. It is actually a locale. It is a truly existent place, which is hell or which is heaven. Yeah.
Isn't all existent a mind state?
That's a religious statement according to a particular understanding of consciousness. The school on which this is based wouldn't follow that one. It is also a mind state. Obviously, you cannot take this apart from mind states. But the Buddhist texts will leave no doubt that there are such things as hells. You know, these are not just metaphors. But obviously, the most interesting things, if you happen to sit in the human realm, as we all do right now, is to look at this and say, well, how does this apply to my world? Mm-hmm. You know, what is the quickest ticket to the hell realm? Yeah, and you clearly realize that acting on hatred definitely is the quickest ticket to hell. Yeah, when you behave like a hungry ghost, you're very likely to be reborn as a hungry ghost. The connection is very obvious
in
there.
This life.
Well, you can consistently behave like a hungry ghost in this life, then you probably start looking a bit funny, yeah? But you definitely are more likely to make an appearance in the hungry ghost realm in the next life if you have consistently behaved like one in this life. Mm-hmm. Very obvious it is in the way of in the realm of animals. Yeah?
Mm. All of this is like the belief of there are hells and all these are realms. It's in the original Pali Sutras, or is it commentary?
No, the Pali texts speak of hell realms very clearly. The Sutta Nipata speaks of agonizing hell realms. You know, there's word of being tortured, and being burnt, and being frozen. There is no doubt, if you look at the text, these are actually literal places. Obviously, our enlightened age, in the sense of Western enlightenment, would like to reduce these things to metaphors, because we've come from monotheistic religion that taken these hell realms a bit too serious, and so Buddhists like to be free of that stuff, and they don't like the idea of going back into heavens and hells again. But if we
find it, it was amazing to find it.
It is there, yeah.
Now we have six of them.
You have a lot more. You know, this is just a summary. What you get here, you have a lot more hells than that.
What does he hold here in his hands?
He holds a bomb. Generally, he holds a little vessel of the balm supreme to cure all ills. So. I would be hesitant to gloss this away as metaphors or while I favor personally, one of the things that touches me most is the psychological applicability of Buddhist teaching. That is what has attracted me to the Buddhist teaching. And I confess to some ideologies, I do think instilling people with fear is not great didactic teaching. I do not think this is very great. Although it is time-honored, Christians have done it. I don't know whether Jews are doing it. Chinese Buddhists have been doing it. In fact, just about every religion I can think of, and I have at least some familiarity with, seems to at some point rely, or people claiming to teach this religion seem to rely on instilling fear on their disciples. In fact, not just religions. The basic principle that people do things because they fear punishment seems to be easily relied on by governments, by teachers. So this is not a particularly enlightening aspect, because one of the things fear does, as you can see in the animal realm, it decreases the capacity to reflect, it decreases curiosity, it decreases the very potential to understand, which in the Buddhist teaching is the sole liberating instrument. Yeah, it's our capacity to understand, because once we understand, we are likely to choose what is healthy, what is wholesome, what is leading to happiness. So by using fear to instill a religious teaching, in some way is counterproductive. It's not just bad taste, it's definitely counterproductive, because it seems to decrease the very ability we need to develop to actually free ourselves. I personally experience fear as the most crippling and the most... I'm at the most unfree in my own heart where I'm afraid. So I do not like to emphasize fear-inducing teachings. But I'm also have to be honest with you. I have great respect for the Buddhist teaching and the texts and the living tradition in which I have grown up in some ways. And I would lie to you if I tell you these are just symbolic teachings. I would lie to you if I say, no, these teachings are not there. They are there. And whether you make much of them or you make none of them, I'm not going to talk them out of existence. So,
can I just
please
have some comments about the, I think what is confusing about different realities is the perception of our mind right now of what are different realities. Because if you go to the old thoughts of where it came out from, so you can see that the mind that has created those kind of thoughts was a much more it talked about different states of consciousness, and consciousness is reality and reality is consciousness. So it's not to see the reality in our perceptive mind of this is reality, the matter reality, the mind matter reality, but to see it in a much more expanded way of different consciousness which reality takes place. So it's not that there are like human beings, ghosts, or, you know, with the matter and flesh and hell, but those are states of consciousness. This is all the Hindu gods talk about. What is a Hindu god? It's not just a picture. It's not a flesh and matter which symbolizes like us, like humans. Those are states of consciousness which have their realities. They are living realities because they are living states of consciousness. Am I coherent?
No, you're very coherent. This is, I would say, this is a religious statement. This is a mode of understanding. I can sympathize with that, but I would have to disagree with you on the fact that this is what early Buddhism is about.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yes.
I'm conscious of that there is such a way of understanding, but in early Buddhism you would have to understand that consciousness is primarily sense consciousness. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Consciousness is always consciousness of something.
Yes.
There is... So to attribute consciousness a cosmological quality with different layers on which different degrees of substantiality or so take place. I understand this, but this is not what early Buddhism would teach. Early Buddhism would teach what you do depends on your degree of understanding, and your degree of the quality of the results of that depends on your quality of intention.
Yeah.
If you're confused the results of your actions will be painful. If you're greedy, the results of your actions will be painful.
Yeah, of course, yeah. That's in a psychological plane. But what in the simple psychological human plane, we try to catch those conscious worlds as matter. So we want to see a picture, and we see it as a picture, and this is not way to see it. To understand that it those are realities is not to see with the same glasses we look in the human reality. You have to change your glasses in order to...
Give me an example of what you mean.
Yeah?
Give me an example, please, of what you mean, just to make sure that I understand you.
You mustn't look... I can just say you mustn't look at it in a thought of that it has a matter context. I mean, not the same matter we have in our human form. I mean, you can have like energy forms. You have different. You can be in contact with different forms of life, which are not matter condensed. That's what I say.
Yes.
So you have to just change your glasses in order to get into different planes of consciousness to see other worlds.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I said.
And what? How does that relate to?
Because you know, people think those are legends. You know, you have hell,
you have heaven,
you have this kind of realm. This mythology is it just a psychological interpretation?
I understand. I think you're trying to get at the point that do I have now to believe that if I go to the ground floor here, and is there underneath the ground floor a few basements, and below the basement a few more hell realms? Yeah.
Right.
I think the model of reality has to be questioned. You know, a rainbow, on one level, is perfectly real, isn't it? If you look at the effect of a rainbow in the literature of this planet, then you see rainbows have played a role in all great epic traditions. They have appearance. They have moved people. People have given significance to rainbows, and yet, if you go and catch the rainbow, or if you want to freeze it or produce it, it's not so easy, isn't it? It is a reality that you can't buy or eat or conserve, but it nevertheless is a reality. It occurs. Yeah. If you understand what it is, it may be an august, an auspicious sign, rather than a ethereal and intangible something that recedes as soon as you approach it. Yeah, I understand that you question an everyday consensus of reality when we approach these realms, if I am correct. Mm. Yeah, then I would strongly agree with that. Mm. I would like, if you're okay, move to the outer circle, which is, in fact, the 12 links of dependent origination. Somewhere is the colorful version. Is it?
Yeah.
I'm hiding it. So please have a look at this.
Thank you.
Unfortunately, the scale of our sketch here is not so great. I had to shrink it before I sent it off to Tor and Itamar, and to make it manageable on email. But you'll see, we start up under the left tooth of Lord Yama. I mean, the obvious thing about dependent origination is it's a circle. We speak of it as something that has 12 links, and we speak of it as if it begins with ignorance. But in fact, it doesn't begin. And that's the whole point of dependent origination. A beginning is unthinkable. For practical reasons, we start somewhere. But it doesn't actually mean this thing bites its own tail. Yeah, that's one of the major principles. Unless we change our attitude, as I hope to point out tomorrow, we change our attitude to suffering fundamentally, it's going to continue. It's the snail biting its own tail, being scared what bites its tail, biting faster, biting harder. So we have a blind man or a blind woman walking towards an abyss, top underneath the left tooth of Yama. This is the Tibetan depiction of ignorance, blindness, avidya, not seeing. So it's somebody walking with a bent back towards an abyss while being blind. This is the statement of our existential condition when we operate under the influence of ignorance or delusion. The next stage, you see a potter making pots. Pali runs avijja paccaya sankhara. Sankhara, I tried briefly addressing yesterday, are basically conditions. All conditions contain an element of will. The most dominant feature of sankhara is that they are made up, that they are fashioned in some way, and they generally contain an element of will. Now, examples of sankhara in our lives are our emotions. We have perceptions, we have sensations, we have feelings, but out of these things occur emotions. And an emotion is already something that has a charge, maybe a mild charge or a strong charge, but it has a direction, it has a degree of intentionality. Now, this intentionality is one of the crucial things in sankhara. What we see is the potter making pots. Some of these pots are good pots, some of these pots are bad pots. The potter stands for the mind creating, fabricating aspects of reality. The good, bad pots stand for the quality of our actions. The things we do are colored by the quality of our intention. Our intention, in turn, is colored by the degree of understanding or the degree of blindness. Our actions can only be as good as our intentions. Our intention can only be as good as how much we have understood. So out of a blind person's actions are likely to come painful results, results that are unsatisfactory. That's another word for dukkha, maybe a more useful word. The translation of dukkha, not just as suffering, but as unsatisfactoriness. Then the next stage, you see a monkey. Monkey running. Monkey, often in Buddhist psychology, is used as an image for vijnana, for consciousness. Have you ever seen a monkey? And I'm not speaking of apes, I'm speaking of monkeys. They are generally very restless. One of the images of vijnana, the consciousness in Buddhist sense of the term, sense consciousness, it is like a monkey grabbing one branch of a tree and swinging itself to the next branch, letting go of this, swinging itself to the next. So consciousness swings itself from one type of contact to the next type of contact. So for eye consciousness, I go to thinking a bit, and then thinking, I go to hearing, and then I eat something, and I go to tasting. So, yeah, this is what consciousness does. It continually entertains itself with contact. So vijnana, in this sense, is the capacity, is the monkey jumping hither and thither, jumping up and down, back and through, back and through. Next stage, the next nidana, is nama rupa. This is the psychophysical organism. Nama means the name aspect of things. It means the mind aspect of things. And rupa means the corporeality. Now, I have to tell you, this is not mind and matter. I am very adamant about this. We have a fantastic religious teaching and a profound religious psychology which understands that the world cannot be split in mind and matter. And we're not going to let that creep back in. It has taken Western philosophy 2,500 years to come to terms with this, and it's still not very conclusive, but this mind-matter split is a disaster because it doesn't actually account for our experience. In Buddhist teaching, all experience has a corporeal aspect. Basically, it is resistance. Yeah, the way we touch the world has to do with different degrees of resistance. If there is a lot of extensiveness in that resistance, then we call it earth. Buddhists call it earth. If there is a lot of fluidity, then we call it water. If it is hot, temporal, wavy, warm, we call it fire. Yeah. If it is motile, we call it air. And so the Buddhists who are generally not terribly interested in the physical world, yeah. Buddhists have produced lots of psychologists, grammarians, epistemologists, they've been produced great logicians, fantastic translators. They've never been producing great physicists so far. You know? The Buddhist take has been very much the world is the world of my senses, of my experience. Suffering cannot be addressed by manipulating the outside world. Now this is on one hand very realistic, on the other hand it is a disaster. You know? When you go and visit Tibet, you realize these people have fantastic depictions and a profound understanding of interior processes when meditating. Problem is, most people don't meditate, and most people actually need decent chimneys in their lives. Because if you don't have decent chimneys, and if you don't bother learning how to build decent chimneys, you're very likely to have smoke in your room. And if you have smoke in your room, you have eyes that are inflamed. If your eyes are inflamed, you have eye infections. And, you know, you end up with a statistic of 4 times as many blind people in one place than in another place because you build lousy chimneys. So, chimney is something on the roof. Yeah? Yeah? Got it? Yeah. So, one of the problems is if you are not bothering with the physical world, then some things are very hard to manage, and building decent chimneys may not make you terribly enlightened. It makes for happy eyes and happy children, for example. Yeah? So there is something to be said for negotiating the physical world, and this may be one of the areas Buddhism has to learn from other religions or has to learn from other ways of negotiating the material world. By tendency, the Buddha has very clearly understood that the suffering originates in the human heart. This is not a picture of the world. This is a picture of what's happening in the human mind in response to conditions. And this is a crucial distinction. So we have one of the few things the Buddha says about the world out there is that there is no such a world out there. The world out there only becomes world in the way it contacts our senses. Yeah. World arises. You know, this is dependent. If you want the literal translation, it's samuppada. It arises together. Sam means co-arising. Yeah. So we need different things to happen for this world to arise. One aspect is some kind of resistance, corporeal resistance, which the four elements cover. Four elements and 26 forms of derived matter, as the later tradition has it. The other side is how this is being met by the sensory apparatus of the human mind. Yeah. We'll see that later on. So you have nama, which covers the sensory apparatus, and rupa, which basically means form or shape. Literally, rupa is shape. It's that which... it's shape and shadow. That it's the visible object, that which the eye can see. Sometimes it's used for as a short term for the so-called material world. Then, so you see, nama is the people in the boat looking, and rupa is the boat itself. So let's go back. Blindness, conditions, blindness is the basis for conditions or for volitional formations, as the technical term goes, the potter. Volitional formations are the basis for consciousness. Consciousness occurs with the way we intend things. We can direct our intentions. By the way we direct our intention and we attend to things, we get certain results. Yeah? We can sit here and watch the breath and the mind becomes quiet. We can go next door and watch TV. The mind becomes less quiet. This is to do. These are two different modes of attention. We can choose. Because the TV is not quiet, if we attend to the TV, the mind will become excited. Sometimes we like that, sometimes we don't like that. You know, we often respond differently to the same stimulus.
So is consciousness vijnana or citta? No, vijnana here.
Here it is vijnana. For those interested in the Buddha's early discourses, the Buddha doesn't define the term citta. He almost consciously seems to refrain from actually defining it. There are a few passages which equate citta with mano and vijnana, and the commentarial tradition has taken those three or so passages and said citta is always vijnana, but actually that is not true. When we look at how the Buddha speaks, he speaks of citta, of the mind, when it's about to be purified, when it is to be developed, when it is to be concentrated. So when he speaks of growing, developing, purifying, cultivating, he speaks of citta. When he speaks analytically, he uses the term vijnana.
So. And it's part of the Cetasikas?
No, the Cetasikas are the commentarial attempt to explain the commentarial unease with the vagueness of the term citta. Mm. Yeah. Cetasikas are a commentarial term, and the Abhidhamma tradition has tried to replace what the Buddha called citta by 52 Cetasikas, which they then grouped and categorized. I find it telling that the Buddha didn't seem to think this is necessary to do. It seems to speak more of the needs of commentators than of the needs of the Buddha. Yeah. So you would need to adopt a different model if you want to find citta and cetasikas together. Here, the term vijnana is very basic. Yeah. It speaks, maybe a brief footnote here, the term vijnana means separative knowing. It means consciousness is intrinsically separative. In the way we become conscious of something, we split the world between an apparent subject being the receiver of an apparent objective piece of information. The term vijnana consists of a prefix vi, which in this instance means it splits. It's like the Greek dai, yeah? It splits something. It's a jnana means knowing. It's a knowing that is split. Yeah? Vijnana, as opposed to jnana, is always a separative knowledge. It is a knowledge of world and I. And in that knowledge already, the fundamental split which breaks object and subject apart has occurred. So in many ways, vijnana is part of the problem. The way to know the world through vijnana will end us up in a suffering position, a world that does not follow our expectations. So that's one of the great insights in Buddhist teaching, that our mode of actually looking into the world is part of the problem, or is the crucial problem in itself. It's not an easy term, if you bear with me for a moment, because the term also has different roles in the different places it turns up. Here it is meant in a very basic way. It is, it speaks of a certain habituation that the mind likes to have its senses stimulated. Now, there is some intrinsic movement of the senses out into the world. Yeah. We see things. We don't need to order our eyes to see. The eye actually seems to be going out and look. You know, we hear things. Even if we want to stay here, some impulse in us reaches out. As if through vijnana, through the various sense bases, energy of the mind is continually reaching out, like big feelers into the world. Yeah, inside into our thinking, memorizing, synthesizing, imaging. Outside, hearing, smelling, tasting, yeah? Mm-hmm. So this is vijnana, the monkey, the restlessness. Once one of them is shut down, we really grieve. Or if you can't move and you can't smell and you can't see, you really start feeling the push behind our senses. Yeah? If you for some reason are deprived, or you have deprived yourself of actually using your sense faculties, you realize what a tremendous energy is there behind it. In fact, we need to exercise these senses, to even develop as children, it's very... if we do not use these senses, we atrophy. This is very clear. In fact, it probably takes a baby several weeks, if not months, to actually distinguish its sense bases. I'm not a child psychologist, but I have read my books, and if we believe Piaget, then it takes quite a while before we actually can distinguish what we see or what we hear. Or we get the fact that it is pleasant or unpleasant, but we don't necessarily get that what is unpleasant is strong light or cold temperature. Or so it takes quite a while till we actually can distinguish our sense bases. Nevertheless, as with the process of birth, I conclude that you probably have successfully completed that process by now, and like to proceed from Namarupa to Salayatana. Down here you see the house with six windows. That's very straightforward. And apt, Salayatana means the six, the domain of sixes. Here, meant is the six sense bases. Yeah. So our hearing, our seeing, our smelling, our tasting, our touching, and our mind faculty of concept, image, and imagery. So, next you see the lovers on the bed. This is the Tibetan version of contact. This is the stage where actual impingement on our senses takes place. Here, a very pleasant form of impingement, and the contact speaks, is the precondition for what follows. Yeah.
What is impingement?
Impingement is you're being touched. Something hits you. Something hits your sense sphere. You know, a color or a sound.
Mm.
Yeah. Now, if that is impingement, is the term for you're being contacted. Let's put it like
through
that.
A sense.
Yeah. Contacted through a visual stimulus, an auditory stimulus, a tactile stimulus. So if we get contacted, sometimes we like that, you know. But that way we like it, that way it gets a bit rough, you know. If it gets more rough, then all this is contact. It doesn't say anything about pleasant or unpleasant. But it means we are sensible. Sorry, we are sensitive. That's one of the problems. We are, when we are children, we're totally vulnerable, totally sensitive, and we have no control over our environment. One of the things we do as we grow up, we learn to increase the degree of control, to manipulate the intensity and the quality of contact in our senses. So, but we cannot avoid contact, because the senses, you know, cannot be shut. Even if you close your eyes, you still have some light, you know. And with the ears, it's already more difficult. We cannot close our ears, really. Camels can, apparently. I'm not even sure whether they stop hearing. Maybe just no sound gets in. So it means we are vulnerable. As soon as we're in the world, as soon as we're born, we experience contact. We have no choice. We have choice in maybe manipulating degrees of contact, but the existential fact that there is contact, we have no choice. The next step, this is directly connected to this, you see a man that has an arrow in his eye. If you see the colorful picture, it's probably very...
In his eye.
In his eye.
Well, you're hard to see.
Yeah?
Yeah.
There's a lot of room for imagination in this picture.
Oh, yes, yes. Now, the Buddhist term for that, so we have Namarupa Paccaya Salayatana, the sixth sense sphere, Salayatana Paccaya Passa, contact.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next one is Passa Paccaya Vedana. Now it's getting interesting. Vedana in Buddhist psychology is something that cannot really be translated. We say feeling, but in fact it's not feeling. It is a particular quality of feeling. It is pleasant, unpleasant or neutral. Yeah. In fact, feeling is misleading as a translation. It's just that we have no real word for it. What it really means is the degree of pleasure we derive from something, or displeasure. If you want a technical word, we have psychologists amongst us, you may call it the hedonic tone, yeah? The hedonic quality, the quality of pleasure we get out of something. Now, in practical experience, we stick with pleasure or displeasure because the neutral bit we generally don't get. Yeah? We don't register that. Mm. It's difficult enough to get the subtle pleasures. So the things that register as neutral, we generally don't notice. It's just, they're just boring. Yeah? Just, next, please. Yeah. Mm. So what is meant with Vedana is that there is a evaluation of our experience any moment, that what we experience in our senses is either pleasant or unpleasant. So the thought you have in your mind right now is, if you look closely, pleasant or unpleasant. The sound you hear is pleasant or unpleasant. The posture you hold is pleasant or unpleasant. The idea that goes through your head right now is pleasant or unpleasant. It's amazing that we have no word for that in Western psychology.
Some mix it with emotions. No,
it's a disaster, yeah.
It's a disaster. I always say it's not emotion.
No, it's not. I'm completely in agreement with this. Vedana is actually, it's in many ways a mental process. It is a value judgment that something is interesting, agreeable, pleasant, or holds lust, yeah, holds some degree of gratification, not the word.
Mind senses. The mind senses.
Yes, there is something in the mind that decides this is gratifying or this is not gratifying. And obviously, one of the crucial things that happens is this little decision, which happens generally so fast that we don't notice it, decides how much attention goes to something. Because obviously, we are not neutral. We favor pleasant experience. We favor interesting experience. We favor gratifying experience. So as soon as we have this little choice, we give our attention to the thing that is gratifying. Yeah. Akinjana looks at the beautiful tree. He doesn't know what it is called. He doesn't look at the rubbish heap just below it. Yeah. If you give him the choice. Yeah. Before he doesn't need to think about this. You give him the tree and the rubbish heap, and he will, you know, habitually go with his attention to the tree, particularly because it's flowering. Yeah. So this quality of Vedana is very, very underestimated. It is totally crucial in the economy of attention. So if we meditate, one of the first things we try to do is disconnect our willingness to give attention only to pleasant things. We say, we are going to give attention to all things that happen right now in my body, say, or in my mind. I'm not just giving attention to the nice things, to the fascinating things, to the thrilling things, to the gratifying things. I'm giving attention to my next in-breath. Whether it's fascinating or whether it's boring, doesn't matter. It's happening and I'm giving attention to it because it's happening. Yeah. So we learn, we re-educate the ability of the mind to choose an object of attention not on the basis of pleasure, but on the basis of choice, yeah? On the basis of physical occurrence. So here, in this very vivid image, Vedana is something we cannot avoid. We have no choice about Vedana. It is not something we can choose. We cannot choose not to have Vedana. We can choose how we respond to it, but we cannot choose to have Vedana or not. Up till now, no choice. Yeah? Please?
How does sankharas play into the Vedana in the where we go, to the pleasant or to the unpleasant?
Well, obviously they play a lot in there. You don't just get one round of this cycle running. You get several rounds running at once. You know, one runs like this, one runs like this. Yeah? So sankharas are the volitional impulses that generally seek gratification. They seek... Now, we seek states, you know, in the things we do in our lives, or we do not seek things, we seek states. You know, you don't drive the car, you drive to drive the car you drive. You drive the car, you drive to have a feeling that car gives you. You don't want to be famous because being famous is good. You want to be famous because it feels good being famous. You know, you don't want to receive love, recognition, appreciation. Yeah. We want to feel that way. So sankharas are propelling us to do things from which we promise ourselves that we get the feeling we feel gratified by. Am I clear? Yeah.
This Vedana quality is pretty much dependent or determined or directed through our sankharas.
Yes, yeah. It did all of this. In fact, the problem is that it does more than that. It says, let's do that and I will get that. And then it also says, it evaluates. Yeah. So you eat your first plate of strawberries, which is fantastic, and your Vedana is very positive, and you eat your second plate and it's very positive, and after about the fifth, you know, while doing the same thing, it seems to somehow, the law of diminishing returns, you know, mm-hmm. seems to kick in.
That's the reason the synonym of sankhara is kama. The synonym of sankhara is kama. That's the reason.
I wouldn't make them synonyms, but obviously kama as a big word hinges on the operation on the everyday running of sankharas. This is deep water, huh? you could call kama is the board of directors, while sankharas are the executive operational management. Yeah, if you want it that way. Kama is a big term for the practical development of various sankharic forces. So your sankharas determine the type of action you take, and they also determine, obviously, some of the quality of Vedana, because you cannot maintain an equal degree of response in, because your senses can only be stimulated to such a point. Yeah. Our senses operate with contrast. So we need to change the setting. We need to heighten the dose, or we need to inflict stops. Otherwise, you know, the strawberries start to taste boring, or they lose their sweetness. Or long before you get digestive problems, you get bored with it because it somehow can't keep up. So sankharas are, if they don't let up, they become actually self-defeating, you know.
Yeah.
You get sick of strawberries, and the next time you see a strawberry, you don't recall the sweetness, you recall the sickness of it. So you... all these things are intrinsically linked. So we have Vedana, and now it really gets interesting. Vedana, please.
Can I ask? I'm talking about Vedana, so the basic behavior or pattern that we prefer the pleasant feeling of the pleasant Vedana and you want to reject the unpleasant, is this something that has to basically be changed or reprogrammed? Or
I don't think you can really reprogram that. People want to be happy. You know, at the end of the day, people want to be happy. And they seek happiness through various ways. One of the classic ways to seek happiness is through gratification. You seek pleasant environment, pleasant people, pleasant things to do, pleasant things to eat, so forth. You cannot really reprogram that. You can understand that the type of effort you put into manipulating the world to produce pleasant results is backfiring at you. You can understand that. But I don't think you can actually fundamentally reprogram your wish to be happy. I think that's a healthy wish. The problem is not the wish. The problem is that we try to look for fulfillment where such fulfillment is not really possible. What I meant with reprogramming is, in meditation exercise, Vedana decides, the quality of Vedana decides what do we give our attention to deliberately. In meditation practice we say, we take this deliberately, this apparent deliberate, we take that out, because deliberate means the attention goes to the things I like. Yeah. And we learn to give the attention to something we have decided, say the breath, or a mantra, or a kasina, or a particular topic of recollection. And we learn that we can actually direct attention. Because if we just not direct attention, just normally goes to where it's nice. Yeah. And we don't know that we do that. We just think this is natural, this is normal. You know, it's kind of like you swim in the stream and you go with the current. You think, I'm actually not doing very much. There isn't much current, look. We only notice the degree of current if we turn against the current and try to swim against the current. Then we sense the speed of the current. So in meditation practice, we learn that attention is something we can grant to things we choose. This is very, very fundamental, because this is probably the only real big freedom we have, because our life, our experience becomes what we allow that we attend to. The things we allow into our mind are the things that become our life. And by giving our attention to things that are bad for us and other people, our lives become unhappy.
So there is a quality of overcoming the pull towards the pleasant Vedana.
Definitely, yeah, definitely. We look for something that allows us to recognize that pull. Because most of the time we don't acknowledge the pull in the first place. We just think this is normal. Yeah. What we do, this is the next step. You'll be gratified that this goes along your very question, please.
But isn't meditation reprogramming the mind? Because, according to my experience, once you watch the patterns of your behavior, it starts changing, because you start seeing. So it's like, it changes. The sankharas changes, the things you prefer change, the way you live change.
I think we need to look at that word reprogramming. What I meant to say is, we check a habit. The habit, attention habit, is to go with the things that I like. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And go away, attention goes away from the things I don't like. One of the things we try to do in meditation is to acknowledge that there is such a habit, and then we choose some things we attend to. Whether we like them or we not like them, we stay with them. Mm-hmm. Now obviously this is going to do something in your life. You begin to understand things about your habits. Mm-hmm. And you will recognize, once you recognize the habit, you will recognize it everywhere. Mm-hmm. You will recognize it in yourself, you will recognize it in her, you will recognize it in the morning, in the evening. And obviously, once you've realized that this is a bad habit, you will give it up. Mm-hmm. You will change it. So you could say that you reprogram your life. But the first step is that you acknowledge what is already happening. Mm-hmm. See, the problem is with habit is even good habits have to be conscious. You know, every habit is a problem. Mm. Obviously, if you have the choice, kind of take good habits and exchange them against your bad habits. But even good habits are a problem at some point. Because life is fluid, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So we can't get through with a habit. And I think what you mean by reprogramming, this happens. This is wisdom at work, because you realize you have actually a choice. If this doesn't lead to what I like and what is wholesome for me, if I can do it, I can also not do it. Yeah. And you exercise your free will and your choice and reprogram your life, you could say. Are we on the same ship?
Yeah.
Good. So next step, You'll see after the man with the arrow in his eye, you have the drunkard. There is a man drinking. He's holding up the chalice, the cup, and he is drinking. Very crucial Buddhist concept called Trishna or the Tanha, meaning thirst. This is the Buddhist way of saying desire. This is another culprit in Buddhist understanding. You have there the man who is drinking, and part of drinking has to do with need. Human beings need to drink. We consist of a lot of liquid, and we need to replenish our liquids. So drinking not just means desire, it also means looking after our needs. But then there is a point when we do seem to drink more than is called for by our actual need, and the reason why we continue drinking is what we call greed. Yeah. This is something that plays its tremendous role in the Buddha's teaching. And it is so that the Vedana, you remember the arrow in the eye, if the Vedana is pleasant, then what generally happens is that we develop desire. If things are not bad because they're pleasant, it's not a bad thing that we like things or that things are pleasant to us. This is not the problem. The problem is that the things we like, we want more of. The problem is that we are not content. We are not just happy for things to be pleasant. We want it again. We want to buy it. We want to own it. We want to marry it. We want to inhabit it. Forever. Yeah. And preferably in slightly increasing ways, so that the decrease of my sense faculty is matched by the increase of the stimulus. Yeah? Because what was yesterday sweet, today is no longer sweet. I need to add another one. So this is a psychological experience the Buddha called thirst. I need to make a little digression here. Desire is not just desire. It's definitely the English term desire is slightly connotated with sexuality. It is not just sexual desire, although obviously sexuality is the great epitome for the wish for gratification. But desire in Buddhism has three different distinct forms. One form is desire that we have for, let's call it experience. We like our senses to be used. There is a very fundamental gratification for using our senses. I'm not sure whether the technical term is correct, but in German it's called a functional gratification. Even if we look at things we don't like to look at, hear things we don't like to hear, this is more pleasant to do so than to hear nothing, to see nothing. So the mere usage of our senses is in some way, in a rudimentary way, gratifying. If you have ever tried abstaining from using your senses, you will notice what I'm saying. If you're sitting in the dark for a while, or if you're in one of these chambers that have no sound. So this type of gratification that we can get at by seeing, hearing, touching things, by tasting things, by smelling things, and by thinking and imagining things. This is what the Buddha called kama tanha. Not to be confused with kama. The word kama with a long A means sensuality. It means sense object, it means sensuality in itself, and it means gratification. So kama, the thirst for sensuality in all six senses. Even reading a poem is sensuality, so don't be fooled. So that's the first type of desire. Anything that in our heart is directed to gratification of this type of sense experience. The second quality the Buddha calls bhava tanha, which means the thirst for becoming. This is a desire that is directed towards so-called abstract qualities like fame or reward, recognition, love, power. This is not an immediate sense experience, and yet, as you very, very well know, much effort can be put in obtaining power, for example, control. A desire for prosperity in a sort of abstract sense, for, you know, being rich.
It should be appreciated.
Definitely. Yes. So this is something we very well know, that we desire these things, and yet they're not immediate. You know, being rich is not an immediate sense experience. Yeah, being loved is not an immediate sense experience. Having power is not an immediate sense experience. And yet, it is definitely something human beings often aspire to and put great, great effort into obtaining. So this is the second quality of desire. Bhavatana. Buddha calls this becoming. This is the wheel of becoming. This type of thirst produces a faster speed of this wheel. Yeah. Or more wheels, depending which analogy you favor. The third type of thirst is referring to the desire to get rid of things. It's the opposite of the second desire. We want the things that are happening stop happening. We want to be free from something. We want to get rid of something. Also, it is directed towards abstract qualities. It takes different shapes. It's a pleasure we get of getting rid of something. Cleaning, yeah, for example. It's a gratification of such a desire. Yeah, makes us feel good. When I don't know, when I'm stuck in a piece of work and I clean my desk, or I rearrange my hard disk, or something like that, do a virus scan, that's the cheapest way. Don't even have to sit there, just upload the latest signatures, get it running, and do something else, and feel good, have done something good. Something is, yeah? Clean, or rearrange things. Throwing a half-empty tube, you know, kind of squeezing out the last bit of your toothpaste on your brush, double the amount than you really need, but then you can throw away the tube. Yeah? That's the gratification for vibhavatana, the desire to undo something.
Also in the cycles of psychology of mania depression, becoming and non-becoming. Becoming and depression, the non-becoming.
Oh, you fit the whole picture in there, yes. If you want, you
all
can.
All suicide attempts are the passion of.
Definitely, getting rid of myself, yeah, because myself is hurting. Yeah. I get rid of that. Yes.
All the false notion of nibbana as not becoming is also connected to getting rid of life. The false notion of nibbana, getting rid of life, comes under the category of desire of not becoming.
Yeah, of non-being. Yes.
Non-being. Yeah.
Yes, obviously there is a good deal. If you wanted to apply this to various psychopathologies, definitely,
yeah,
you find anything from feeling a little bad and taking a snooze and annihilating yourself for an hour to full-fledged Freudian thanatos drive, or so you can pack under the desire to not become or not be. It's crucial to identify these traits in our desire psychology. Sensory desire, kamatana is obvious. You know, we like certain things, we don't like other things. Bhavatana, probably quite imaginable. We like feeling safe, or feeling loved, or feeling powerful. Vibhavatana, we tend to be a bit more stingy with our acknowledgement. But there is, you know, there are various aspects in our psychology that manifest the trait of vibhavatana. Wanting to get rid of those additional 10 kilos of our body weight, or slight self-punitive habits or so that creep in, you know. Not enjoy things because we might get attached to them. Yeah, sometimes Buddhists are prone to such things. Buddhist monks sometimes eat particularly fast so that they don't enjoy what they eat, because they know if I enjoy it, I might get attached to it. Yeah? Which is not just bad Buddhism, it's also bad for your digestive system. This kind of thing. So it's not necessarily as obvious as the first two types, but there is a desire in there, and sometimes you would be surprised at to what degree we are willing to make ourselves suffer or to do bad things to us, or to get rid of things, to not allow ourselves to feel things or to acknowledge needs. Yeah, exactly, deprivation.
Acknowledge what?
Acknowledge need. Yeah. There's a big culture, you know, wherever you find austerity is a virtue, or wanting little, or that contentment is a virtue, you find a tendency often to not acknowledge the difference between need and desire. Because they both, in many ways, they feel like, I need this, yeah? And if you deprive yourself of things that are plain desires, then you tend to grow through that. You tend to grow
condemn
stronger.
You condemn yourself for
that is a variant of it, but even worse than that is non-acknowledgement of need. Now, if you do not acknowledge needs, the result is not growth or strength or decisiveness. The result of non-acknowledgement of need is depriving yourself. Is distraction. Is you atrophy. Mm-hmm. You know, you kind of, it just
narrows you.
It narrows you. Yeah, it's you shrivel.
Of
yes. I see that you completely get me. So, we have, when we have the drunkard here, who has, you see he has several cups on his table. And on my depiction, he has several cups on his table. The man drinking, the movement of tanha is the fundamental drive that propels us to action. And we have to use our own wisdom to discern need from desire. And this is not easy. Mm-hmm. It's a lot easier to deprive ourselves of things or to indulge. But to actually find measure is a great art. And you also see you can't be too normative about this, because people's needs differ. Mm-hmm. If you have lived with people in a sort of uniformed way, then you will notice that some people eat a lot less than others. You can't say you have all to eat the same amount or to sleep all the same amount. I've lived like that, and it's obvious if you put people in monastic gear and you give them a monastic schedule, and you give them monastic robes and monastic life conditions, they're totally different. They read the same books, eat the same foods, you know, sleep, meditate, work under the same conditions, and yet they're totally individual, both in their needs and in their gifts. It's crucial, you know, this act of distinguishing what our needs are and where our desire begins is something we can only do for ourselves. Mm-hmm. Obviously, a good deal of parenting and a good deal of schooling is normative. You know, and there is an intrinsic injustice in this, as we all know. It may not be possible to completely adapt the various systems to the individual needs, but we definitely need to acknowledge that such a decision, where one ends and the other begins, is a product of our own insight. It's a product of our own self-knowledge. And nobody else can do that. So there is just a word of caution by adopting religious standards. Particularly if they are translated from other cultures or other times, it may do gross injustice to our own needs. Yeah. Tanha, until now, if you're born, and if ignorance is to some degree working in our system, there is not much choice. As long as ignorance is at work, we'll be having impulses in our heart. We will try to gratify these impulses by using our senses. With our senses, we'll develop a psychophysical organism. Yeah, that psychophysical organism has, again, six outlets. That these six outlets make us liable to contact in all spheres of our experience. The fact that we have contact with our senses will produce results. We will like some of this, we find some of this gratifying or not gratifying. The things we find likable, we are very likely to develop desire, thirst for. We don't really have much choice in the matter up till there. The real choice we start having now between the drinker and the next monkey. You'll see a tree with fruit. That's a strange creature I have here. I'm not even sure it's a monkey. Generally, it's a monkey, but it could be. It's a woman here, yeah?
It's Eve taking the apple, attaching herself to the apple.
Sorry, you're in the wrong channel. You're in the wrong channel here.
This is a great culture.
It's a Darwinian sketch.
I thought you offered it rather than took it, actually. So, in the colourful picture, it's a monkey, but I'm sure it works with a woman as well. Because you will be surprised. It's not going to take a good ending, actually. So, the Pali word for the process is called upadana, which means grasping. Yeah, dana means giving. Adana means taking, upadana means taking very hard or very much. Yeah, it's the strengthening, taking up. The translation for it is either grasping, that is the direct image, or it is identification, that is with mental content. Yeah. When we grasp, here the monkey or the woman reaching for the fruit.
It's still mental, by the way, the grasping.
No.
It's physical and mental?
Depends what the object is. You know, if the object of your grasping is a thought, then you would call it identification, then it's mental. But if the object of my grasping right now is an angry impulse at an unpleasant question, I might actually reach over here and grasp the questioner. Yeah? Then it's a physical impulse.
Okay.
It's basically the decision to enact your desire. Yeah, so you are going to make not just with thirst, desire, you have an object and you have an impulse, but you haven't acted on it. With grasping, you actually are going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, if the object of that grasping is mental, is an image or a fantasy, you follow it.
Mm-hmm.
You say, it's mine. You know, this is a stupid thought, I'm a stupid person. Yeah, but if you, the object, as here with this woman, is a fruit, you actually go, and this is not just a fruit, unfortunately it's in the neighbor's garden, but nevertheless, there's one hanging over here and I take it. Yeah? This is grasping in a quite literal sense. You turn it into action. Now, this is just to start, this is where Buddhism kicks in. Yeah? Up till about, you know, passa, vedana, tanha, you don't really have much choice. You cannot have no desire. You know, if you have desire, you have desire. All you can be honest about it, or you can be not honest about it. Yeah. But if the things that you experience through the sense fields, the contact, the vedana, give rise to desire, you have no. Sometimes you have a lot of desire or a little desire, but the only choice you have how honest you are going to be with yourself. And then you have the choice what to do with that desire. Now you can enact it, yeah? You can do something to gratify the desire, or you can decide to bear it, yeah? To just have desire. You take a breath and say, wow, God, this is desire. Really.
And for your needs.
And?
If you grasp it for your needs, not for your desire.
Well, then it's, if you know, if this is need, then
it doesn't
work. Yeah, you see, need doesn't imply blindness. Yeah, the old lady here walking towards the abyss is blindness. Now, need is not something you have a choice about. Mm-hmm. But desire you have a choice about.
Mm-hmm.
So if this is the cycle, if you want, this is the biography of a little moment of your consciousness
mm-hmm.
under the influence of blindness.
Mm-hmm.
So grasping is something, with grasping you actually affirm the whole pattern. When you decide to enact your thirst, your desire, by grasping, by going about gratifying that desire, you say yes to every single instance in here. You say yes to the contact, you say yes to the thirst, you say yes, finally, to the blindness at the top of it. Yeah.
Mm.
Because what's happening, if you gratify your desire, it goes away for a moment, but then it comes back a little bit stronger, a little bit more persistent. And that's the problem with desire. The problem is not that it couldn't be quenched. It can very well be quenched. The problem is the more you quench it, the more demanding it gets. You seem to strengthen it.
Mm.
You affirm it.
So having the desire is not greed?
No. Having the desire depends on how you hold it.
Yeah.
You have choices. You can, if you're willing to bear it, to experience desire as desire, you will notice it stops.
Greed is how you conceive your desire, right?
It's a generic term for impulses. Look, I mean, if you have desire does not multiply itself. If it is not satisfied, it does not increase exponentially. It's like a cat, it comes round. If it gets something to eat, it'll come round again. You know?
Mm-hmm.
If it doesn't get something to eat, it'll come round 3-4 more days, and then it probably goes somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It doesn't mean you've gotten rid of desire, you got rid of this specific desire. Yeah, it goes somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
But it definitely is not going to, you know, you don't get a little pussycat and the next time you get a leopard and the next time you get a tiger. You know, it's not like that. But obviously this has to be put to the test. Yeah, but what certainly happens is if you feed it, it will come back. Yeah, you have a friend. And he brings a friend along, maybe. Yeah. And it's growing stronger. You know, next time it's more of an appetite, maybe. So, the choice, you know, where you can break dependent origination is, opinions vary on that. There is the general agreement, consensus is, between tanha, between desire and grasping, you have a choice what to do. Whether you affirm that desire, whether you enact the movement, and you grasp, you go on to something. And then dependent origination continues. I'd like to take this option and tell you the rest of the story because I'm running out of time here. Questions.
Will you go away?
She has a gun.
So, after grasping, there in my image, generally there should be a pregnant woman. Yeah. Yeah. You have to see, notice that the symbols of pregnancy, birth, and so forth are a bit different in Tibetan iconography as we may be familiar with. But the term is called bhava. It means becoming. That's where the whole wheel gets its name from. This is the process of being pregnant with something. We have had contact, we have had a pleasant experience, we have had thirst after more of that pleasant experience. We have decided to go along with it, to affirm it and to enact that desire. And now this is a fullness, this is the good moment. Bhava is where things are really fine. Yeah. We're happy, pregnant, we're looked after, and we get what we need. Yeah, this is the fullness, plenitude,
also
happiness.
Pregnancy.
That's the image of pregnancy, definitely. Yeah. You forgive a man to say that who has never been pregnant, but this is definitely the moment where we get what we want.
Satisfaction.
It's the consummation.
Yeah, it's the consummation of our grasping. Yeah. And then,
I think it's the image of the fetus that is getting what it needs.
Well, there's several layers in here. certainly that's true, but also something new is being born, yeah, later on. Yeah, but in an ideal scenario, pregnancy, I am told, can be a very gratifying experience. In an ideal scenario, so I have been told. And I'm clear that the image here means that we do exactly, this is the good bit. Baba is the good bit. Things are exactly where we want them to be. And then, if you have, you know, if you go by the fruit, yeah, mm-hmm. Baba is the moment you put the fruit to your mouth and you chew, and the first sucker comes in, yeah? And then you go back, Passa, Vedana, Tanha. Then the next bite comes in. Yeah? Maybe before you finish the first bite, you will already think of the next bite. Or you may not have followed the first bite properly because it's so good that you want more. Yeah. In fact, so much so that you hasten to move away from the first bite to get the second bite. If you're like me, then this is what's happening. Yeah. I remember sitting at my kitchen table many years ago, making my buttered bread, putting in some jam, and actually enjoying the thought of this, putting it into my mouth, and while chewing and savoring the jam, already thinking of the next bite, you know. There was an insight. I realized I couldn't stay with my experience, even though I was longing for that experience. It was gratifying an experience, but the mind couldn't stay with the pleasant sensation of getting exactly what I wanted. It was jumping ahead, you know, onto the next bite. This is bhava, is fullness. Yeah. You get what you want on bhava. But within that, there is also the seed of something new. And the seed of something new, in Buddhist iconography here, is jati, is birth. Now you see, if you look closely, you see a woman kind of lying. And sometimes she's kneeling. And on bigger images, you see a little head coming out of the woman. Yeah, she's giving birth. Yes, if you circulate the colorful picture, you see birthing postures change in various cultures, as you may have noticed. Tibetans don't seem to quite do it in the sort of according to Western obstetric procedure. So the basic concept is, out of our action to affirm desire, to grasp at something, to latch onto something, to enact something, comes bhava, the actual pursuit and the gratification of it. And then comes birth. Something new gets born there. The baby. Implicit is the pain in such birth. And implicit is all the responsibility that we take for what has taken birth there. And then the imagery goes very short. Yeah. The next image, this is shorthand. You see one man going up to a mountain and carrying a bundle on his back. What he carries on his back is probably his dead father. In Tibet, if people die, they're bundled in an embryonic posture. And then they're taken away. In that embryonic posture, they're taken away. Traditionally, they would be taken away onto a mountain where they would be chopped up in bits and the sky burial would take place. I could imagine that this doesn't go down very well here in Israel. But I have actually seen that takes place. People are bandaged, are in a white shroud, and they're bundled. And if anyways, old people look remarkably baby-like in that white package. And then the package is opened by people who are doing this as a profession, and the body is decked out and chopped up into pieces, and then the vultures come and eat the body. And the physical body is recycled into the big cycle of life. So what you have here is, in very shorthand, Vedana, Tanha, Upadana, Bhava, Jati, birth, and then birth conditions old age and death, ultimately. What is being born will have to die one day. Yeah. This is the shorthand for suffering. You know, inevitable in birth, an event we celebrate, an element Tibetan society celebrates. Inevitable in that is the fact that what is born has to die. Now, this, in many ways, is the biography of one single sankhara. If the sankhara is coupled with blindness, it will go through that cycle. Imagine, yeah? The biography of the sankhara makes use of the imagery of birth and death, pregnancy, sexuality, and so forth. So, this is what Paticca-samuppada is about. The terms that underlie these images are there in the Pali canon. They go back to the 5th century, while this particular painting will be a lot later. We know that in the strata of texts immediately after the Pali canon, after the earliest bits of the Pali canon, one of these texts is called Divyavadana. It's said that the Buddha was drawing the wheel of becoming into the sand to explain the nature of three roots of mental poison, the six or the five spheres, and the 12 links of the dependent origination as an explanation. We can be sure that this is very genuine, and I like to spend tomorrow some time on these terms, and particularly on a very interesting teaching on dependent origination that takes it actually from old age, sickness and death, which here goes back into blindness, because pain often makes us more blind. Fear that is implicit in this process, which we cannot escape, makes us also more blind, and the wheel just continues. You realize that this is not just a happy little wheel. This is not just a wheel of life. It's a wheel of life and death, or birth and death. And that if nothing good happens in here, then this will just continue rolling. So there's an option, there's a way out, and well, you have to come back. Good. I'd like to just stop here and see questions. Good. Wonderful. Please.
Yeah, need and desire. If I was from a personal perspective, right? As a baby, let's say a need wasn't fulfilled by my parents.
Yeah.
How would I separate that from the desire now that I've created around that?
Well, this is a tricky one, because obviously you can have needs unfulfilled to the degree that you cannot feel them, and what you get is substitute desires. I guess the short answer is you'd have to identify, you have to in some way learn to know yourself. This learning will take different forms. It will take the form that you compare yourself with what other people's needs are. It will take the form of you look at when you gratify these desires, how does it feel? You know, do you actually come to some sort of form of satisfaction, or do you feel enslaved? Do you feel ashamed? Do you feel depressed? You know, if there's various ways of ascertaining if whether something is need or desire. One way is certainly to look what your neighbors do, but also to look what is the result. If you fulfill it, if you don't fulfill it, what are the results? Human beings have a moral sensibility. You know, Buddha capitalizes on the fact that human beings sense, have a deep sense of what is wholesome and what is not wholesome. While we can blunt that sense and become a bit coarse or callous, but there is a definite ethical sensibility in our hearts. And this will give up signs. If we do things that are unwholesome, we start feeling bad. You know, that badness may be in terms of anger or depression or guilt, or you know, we may experience low self-esteem, or there's all kinds of effects you have. What particularly happens when you gratify desires, you get more desire. So if you grow in dependencies Yeah? If your dependencies increase, if you're more attached to things, if you increase that those needs, you know, there's something funny with the needs. You know? A need is something that can be covered and is met. Yeah? Now, if you sometimes we lose the sensitivity when that need is met, and we need to reestablish the threshold when need stops and desire begins. And this is, you know, this is, I'm not saying this is easy learning, but this can be done by a variety of means. You have enough intelligence to do that, no doubt. Self-observation is part of it. The willingness to actually inquire. Most of the time we're not willing to inquire. Once we inquire, we're quite capable of finding out all kinds of important things about ourselves. But we somehow have decided we don't want in the first place. You know, the aspect of ignorance that is called delusion, it's the unwillingness to learn. Yeah, that's the toughest one. While greed, generally, once it goes into a certain degree of intensity, it is noticeable. You know, the meters go into the red and you realize something's happening here. We cannot fool ourselves after a certain degree of intensity. Anger, the same, you know, the second big poison. Once we certain go from mild aversion to overt hostility to really livid rage, generally we kind of notice something's going slightly out of kilter here. But with ignorance, that's more tricky. You know, ignorance doesn't come with a big sign around its neck saying, "I am ignorance." We don't notice when ignorance is operative. So distinguishing need and greed is something which we need to tackle our seeming innocence, maybe our unwillingness to actually look closely, or to come to some unflattering insights. So it challenges our self-view often. But this is definitely a task of growing up. And growing up and becoming a free human being means we have to become a whole human being. Meditation is a good way to actually look at the effect things have in our lives. And I want to study the effect our actions have in our lives, in our heart. Meditation is a very effective way to do that. Am I answering your question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, good.
Can I just ask, just tell me if I'm wrong, I just had the feeling that you were talking in the psychological aspect of this conditioned law.
Yeah.
And then when you came to birth and death, I just had the feeling that you were not talking only in the you were not touching completely the psychological aspects. You were talking also as birth, the physical birth and physical death. Am I right?
Here they are actually analogies. For they are analogies for this, for the biography of a sankhara. Here they're not really referring to literal birth. These are stark images, like the stark image of the man with the arrow.
So you didn't mean physical birth and physical death?
Physical death is an inevitable fact, and it constitutes some of the suffering. And this is about the arising of suffering, the cessation of suffering. So, but what it means is the death of all sankharas, the death of every single sensory experience.
Yes, but are you on what aspect are you talking? The psychological aspect only, or are you talking also about the Namarupa aspects of birth, becoming, decaying, and the whole human cycle as Namarupa, or only on the level of Nama, on Sankara aspects?
I wouldn't take Namarupa apart. You know, you have a circle that is beginning any volitional impulse under the influence of ignorance is going through these stages. Now, if you look at the individual images, some of these images seem to have more cosmological function. Yeah, The fact that you have six sense bases is something that happens once in your life. Nama-rupa, as a psychophysical organism, consciousness before that, these three here, they seem to speak to more cosmological aspects, because they're givens. You know, I see you in front of me and I sense that you have sense bases, I sense that you have
yeah,
that you manifest nama-rupa.
That's the way you sense me.
Yeah. The sankhara has something to do with a fundamental life force, but it has also something to do with the way you direct your will. By tendency, I favor the psychological application because I think this is immediately applicable, because this is what this is a teaching about.
So when you said, the last sentence you said, that tomorrow we'll talk about the way you get out of the cycle, you mean psychological, how you get out of this cycle of psychological movements, of suffering?
I mean particularly of the link here, which says that out of the fact that things are born, things will have to die, and that death is inevitable, inevitably causing suffering, and that this suffering is giving rise to further blindness. There is another option.
But not every death gives a reaction of ignorance.
No.
It depends of kind of death. If it's an acknowledged death, it won't give us a condition of ignorance.
What Buddhist Samuppada talks of is that by entrenching ourselves through enacting and affirming desire, we entrench ourselves in suffering. The deeper our suffering gets, the less reflective we become, the less of a chance we have to actually respond to suffering in any other way than with blindness.
So what covers it all is suffering. So we can see it in the eyes of suffering. We must look at it in the eyes of suffering, because if we don't look at it in the eyes of suffering, the consequences of death won't be ignorance, because out of suffering, death from suffering is a cover. That would covers the opportunity to see, to acknowledge. That's what you say, suffering. If you have suffering, you can't see. That's the reason you have to take away suffering from yourself.
No.
In order to have a clear mind.
That's not what I say. What I say that the more you suffer, the less opportunities you have.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's the same, what I say.
And yet, at the same time, if you habitually respond to suffering, you will try to avoid it, you will try to repress it, you'll try to distract yourself from it.
So you have more
suffering
like this.
And this is, in effect, the inaction of further ignorance. Yeah. So what I said, that I look at a type of dependent origination, which by altering an attitude to suffering, allows for a different type of circle. I'm not sure whether I respond.
Yeah, yes, yeah. I just want to see where you're taking it to. That's what I...
But the question about nama-rupa was not answered.
So what your car is going to be talking... Are you talking about what Tori is asking now, and I asked before? We're talking about the psychological movement which causes sankhara, which precedes in another sankhara, and which makes our psychological world in behavior, in emotions, in whatever we do in life. But do you correspond also to the actual birth of a human being in this Paticca Samuppada?
Correspond? I'm not sure whether...
To the human birth as matter into the world. As we are talking about it in the cycle, which diverts it into three
mm-hmm.
Lives, are you corresponding to the actual human birth here also?
This teaching?
Yeah.
This doesn't make sense to me that
okay.
way.
Okay.
It this is the biography of a sankhara.
Okay.
You see, this is a teaching aid that helps you understand how your mind operates.
But do you connect sankhara also to the reason why there is a human life on earth? Do you connect it also?
There is no other life than through sankharas.
Right.
Yeah.
That's why I'm asking.
Yeah. The way you have taken information, you know, the color of your eyes, the way your body moves, your age, your health, degree of health, all these are sankharas. These are manifest sankharas. They are based upon previous actions.
So what you're saying, we must unify every movement, psychological, mental, physical movement, because all are connected to sankharas.
I'm glad you're saying that, because that is true. Yeah. Yeah? You have, this thing is operating at many levels.
Right.
It operates at the level, you know. I'm sitting here, I sense my bladder getting increasingly full, I have a definite wish for rebirth somewhere on the loo, and if I go there, I'll probably be reborn in short time on the loo if I make it out there. And after a while, being on the loo, I find it, being on a loo is not really what I really like in my life, and I try to get reborn somewhere else. No? So this is a very immediate psychological application of paticca samuppada. It starts with unpleasant type of contact, not in my eye, but in my bladder. It increases my wish to get out here. It probably propels me very shortly out through that door there. And then I'll be happy for about 10 seconds, you know, with the lessening pressure in my bladder. And then I'll be thinking, where else do I get born? Yeah. And then I get born probably on the outside again, and probably on the parking lot, and then I'll get born somewhere else. And wherever I go, I will have to go away again. Yeah, I cannot stay. So, on a psychological level, this has happened. If I do this, on a deeper level, it has already happened because I'm sitting here. I have here a specific body. My bladder size is such. If it was bigger, then I would not experience this particular condition, for example. So, you know, this whole thing works on it.
Yes, and the reason you had a full bladder is because of this cycle someone else had, your mother,
exactly,
which gave birth to you.
Exactly.
Right.
Then, you know, these levels
yeah.
are not
okay.
separate.
Yeah.
You know, it's unfortunate that our way of thinking seems to exclude levels,
okay.
or we try to play them against each other, but this is a structural principle that applies
okay,
to...
So it's a principle. Right.
Birth and death.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And psychological experience.
We understand everything.
Good. Thank you. See you tomorrow.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Now, one minute, please. Yeah.
In the name of permanency, we want to take some photos.
Good.
If your bladder...
Yes, it was a good example. My bladder can handle that. Thank you.
I hope you don't get enlightened in the blue and stay there.
Yeah, their faces are here. You got them.
Meanwhile, I'll say some words about tomorrow. Please, we begin at 10:30. So if you please come on time, not later than that. And tomorrow we have lunch together, so don't forget to bring something to eat. To remind you, no gatyam, no onion, and no
garlic.
Anything else?
That's spicy. We're happy. It's a great opportunity to hear something we long wanted to hear from someone. Want to spoke something?
Bahawa.
Huh?
Bahawa.
Bahawa. Yeah, this is a great one.